This episode is presented by The Brooklyn Kitchen. Learn more at brooklynkitchen.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, bars, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, gang. My book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession, is now available in paperback. Look for it wherever books are sold.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
The only thing that my dad said was just do what you want to, but just make sure that you're the best at it. I mean, there is no space for mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that has and will always stay with me, because then I keep on pushing myself to go ahead and work harder.
That is Chef Manit Chauhan of Morph Hospitality Group in Nashville, Tennessee, and one of the judges on television's Chopped.
In Family Meal, you're cooking for those people that you spend more time with than you do your own family at home.
Yeah.
Unless you're lucky like me and you get to work with your wife. You're still looking for that same aha moment or just general look of satisfaction from the people who are eating the food that you're making. Mm-hmm. Think about how personal that is. You're making something with your hand that someone is going to put into their body. One, to nourish them, but also to nourish them mentally, because you set up, I mean, most restaurant family meals are prior to the dinner service. You make a great family meal, you've just set the stage for a great service.
And that is Chef Andy Little of Josephine Restaurant, also in Nashville, Tennessee. Those are our two guests on today's special doubleheader episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. I'm here alone today. Some of you know I was in Philadelphia last week, recorded an intro on the drive home with my friend Jenny Dirksen. Prior to that, I was sick for a few weeks, which I mentioned in passing last week. But for anybody who didn't catch that and was wondering why we had sort of an unannounced hiatus, it's because I was down and out with a stomach flu for close to 3 weeks. But I am back. I'm alone this morning, except for my trusty dog, Hudson, here in my home office in Hastings-on-Hudson, New York. And I'm really thrilled to present to you a double feature. Within about an hour of each other, I received emails a few weeks ago, one asking me if I wanted to interview Chef Manit Chauhan. Most of you probably know Manit as one of the judges on Chopped on the Food Network. She also, with her husband, has a company called Morph Hospitality Group in Nashville, Tennessee. They have several restaurants, which we talk about in this interview. But I jumped at the chance to book an interview with her. And within an hour of that email, I got another email asking me if I would like to interview Chef Andy Little of Josephine Restaurant, also based in Nashville, Tennessee. Kind of a crazy coincidence. I ended up interviewing them, as if that weren't enough, within an hour of each other at the Mermaid Inn on the lower east side of New York City. A huge thank you to my friend Danny Abrams, the proprietor of the Mermaid Inn restaurants, for letting me use those spaces now that I've given up my WeWork in the city. It's been a real godsend to the show to be able to use that as a base for recording interviews. The first one I'm going to share with you is with Manit Chauhan. Again, you probably know her from Chopped. She has a huge personality. Quick-witted, funny, energetic, easy to talk to, a bit of an open book. And we get right into it. We got pretty personal pretty fast. And she takes us through her life from her childhood in India through her matriculation at the Culinary Institute of America, and then to various jobs here in the United States before founding this tremendously successful hospitality company and making a name for herself on television, which I suppose is the dream of a lot of culinarians these days. So I don't think I need to say much more about it, and we do have two fairly long interviews, so I'm going to get right to it. This is me and Manit Chauhan recorded in the back room at the Mermaid Inn on 2nd Avenue in New York City just about a week ago. Here you go. So welcome to New York.
Thank you.
You're here filming the show.
Yes.
How often do you come up and do that? Is there a regular schedule?
There is now a regular schedule. We are shooting for around 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
So because there are 9 judges, I'll be here around 20 times or so. So in and out. So it's not a set schedule. It's not that I'm coming every Monday
right.
or Tuesday.
Right.
It is a chunk of dates. I come over, do those episodes, and then head back.
And you are up from Nashville.
Nashville,
okay.
Yeah.
You have lived in a lot of places.
Yes, quite a gypsy feat. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so let's go to the beginning, if we can.
Wow.
Where were you born?
I was born in India, mm-hmm. In a small town in northern India called Ludhiana in Punjab.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up in an eastern town in India called Ranchi,
okay.
where my parents were working.
Okay.
And then I went to school in southern India, mm-hmm. in a town called Manipal.
Mm-hmm.
Worked in Bangalore for a little bit, which is Bangalore right now.
Okay.
The names have changed. And my husband is now from western India. So I call myself United Colors of India.
Okay.
Given that Indian cuisine is so vast...
Yeah.
I love the fact that because I was in all of these places, my cooking style has been influenced by all over.
Right. You said because Indian food is so vast.
Yes.
This is something that's not really appreciated in the United States.
Oh, no. It makes my blood boil. People are like, I don't like curry. I'm like, good for you, because there's nothing known as curry powder in Indian cooking.
Right.
So don't even get me started
on
that.
I don't even mean that. I mean, even people who are familiar with Indian food, you know, if you go back in this country... I don't know, 25, 30 years. Italian food was northern and southern. That was it. Now people know Tuscan food, Venetian food, Roman food, right?
Yeah.
Southern or coastal food, right? There's no sense that Indian food breaks down.
Not yet.
I
think this new generation of ethnic chefs are bringing that to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
For the longest time, I mean, Indian food, like any ethnic food, like be it Chinese food or Thai food, a lot of people started it because that was the only skill that they had.
Mm.
So it wasn't because they were passionate about showing off the beautiful cuisine
mm-hmm.
from the country. It was just that it was a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Hence started all the $8.95 all-you-can-eat buffet.
Right.
Which did more disservice to, a beautiful cuisine than bring awareness to Indian cuisine.
Right.
And I think that is something which I'm seeing a twist, and I'm seeing the turn happening right now. They
right.
are young chefs who are proud of, I mean, who've taken this career because they want to do it. This
yes.
is they're passionate about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Living.
Yes.
Living, drinking, eating Indian
yeah.
food.
Yeah.
And that's what they're getting to the forefront. So I think the switch is happening slowly. It'll take some time.
Yeah.
But I think the turn has started happening.
Okay. So can I slow you down a little bit? I just met you. You just went through like 20 years of your life before we stopped and had that
That's
little talk
it,
about Indian
food. That's it, my life is over. No, I am 20. What are you talking about?
No, but you just went through your whole childhood in 3 or 4 places in about 30 seconds. Okay. Can
right.
we rewind a little bit?
Absolutely.
I want to rewind. The town you grew up in was?
Ranchi.
And what kind of place was that? Size?
It was a really small town. I mean... Growing up, there was one traffic light in the entire city.
Literally.
You can imagine. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Which everybody would ignore. It was... my dad was an engineer, so
mm-hmm.
the colony or the locality that we would live in
mm-hmm.
was a very diverse, in terms of Indian diverse.
Meaning
they
what?
They were like people from eastern India, from northern India, from southern India, from central India.
Why was that?
Because people were moving there for the job.
Mm-hmm.
So it was...
Was it an industrial town?
It was... A part of it was industrial.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there were a lot of people, and which was... Again, to me, everything rounds back to food.
Yeah.
Because I literally would finish dinner at home and then go to my neighbor's houses
yeah.
and tell them that my parents hadn't fed me, so if I could have dinner at their house, which was incredible because then I would eat ingredients, eat dishes, see cooking techniques which were not being implemented in my house.
Yeah.
So it was a amazing, amazing playground for me,
mm-hmm.
a food playground for me.
Okay. When did you start? Did you cook as a child?
Yes, I did.
And was there a family member who helped you with that? Was that your own interest that you pursued through books and television shows and whatnot? What was your entryway?
We didn't have a television for a really long time, and when we did, for some time, it was only one channel. Until 5 o'clock, it used to be only the mosquito dance. I don't know if you...
What?
The mosquito dance, which means there was no reception.
Oh, there was no reception. Okay.
We would call it the mosquito dance.
This is what are they called here in the U.S.? Bars and tones.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
The equivalent of the bars and tones.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And to me, I think it just was... I realized early on that food is such a powerful bonding experience. You can really bond over food. I could go up to anybody, any of the aunties into any house, and just say that I want to help you in the kitchen, and I would, like, it would be an automatic entry into anybody's house. Just
oh, you mean
food.
From the kitchen standpoint?
From
you don't
the
mean
kitchen.
the cliche of sitting around the table and...
Oh, no, from the kitchen.
You mean in the kitchen, cooking with somebody.
Cooking. And I would just
it's
like...
It's a very intimate thing.
It is very. I mean, just to... And a lot of people I've seen, especially home cooks, they cook very instinctively. There mm-hmm. isn't a science behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very... It's a very personal experience for them when they are cooking,
mm-hmm.
be it how much salt they are putting or, you know, what is the secret ingredient that makes their dish so special or so different.
How aggressively it's seasoned.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that to me, I think very early on, I realized that food is something that I could very easily bond with people. And then my older sister, she went to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I would go to meet her, I would take food. And suddenly I realized that I was the most popular kid on campus and I didn't even go to school there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was my aha moment when I realized that, hey, this is something I love to do.
Mm-hmm.
And people love me for it. No brainer.
Okay.
So that's when I very seriously started taking it as a career.
Now, you strike me as an open book. Are you an open book?
Mostly.
Are you not easily offended? Because I'm about to ask you a dicey question.
Oh, I'll offend you right back if I get offended.
Okay.
Don't you worry.
So here's the question.
Right.
You just phrased something in a very similar way to what a lot of chefs and cooks say, but it was with a tweak, okay?
Right.
Normally... Or not normally, the most common version of what you just said is, I really loved cooking, and I loved seeing the pleasure it gave people. You didn't quite say that.
No.
You said, I loved cooking, and I saw how it made people feel about me. That's different.
Absolutely.
Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. I think in the end of the day, we as people have to realize that if we are happy, only then we have the ability to make the people around us happy.
Mm.
If we are miserable and we are making the best food, it does not translate into the food. And I learned that early on, that I need to be happy and confident with what I am doing, and then people will see it. So
mm-hmm.
yes, I think that was there was a lot to do with that.
But you also liked that reaction.
I love the reaction,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, we are chefs. We love reactions. Absolutely.
Okay. Did you, listen, I'm jumping ahead forward with this question, but was there any element in your childhood of performance or theater or anything like that?
I wonder why you're asking me that question. Well, it's my parents and sister, they always pull my leg that I'm quite the drama queen.
Drama queen.
But yeah, but
okay.
Not
on a stage, but a little bit
in
your
mind.
Life.
In
your
mind. Absolutely. And not much has changed.
Do you have an overactive imagination?
I absolutely have an overactive
really?
Imagination. It doesn't, yeah.
Okay.
Surprise, right?
I don't, I mean, we just met.
I grew
you know,
up...
Amanda Crowe, your publicist,
yes.
said... I talk about this more and more in the air. You know, I always get asked I don't know when PR people started, you know, can I have the questions in advance? And the answer is no. I don't.
Oh, I hate. But like, I've told everybody that please don't give me questions.
Well, so for this show, it's right. impossible, as you
exactly.
can already tell. But I told her, I said, you know, I said, I can't. It's the first time we've worked together.
Right.
And she said, well, the truth is, Manit would prefer to just wing it.
Absolutely.
And I said, okay.
I think it's not a matter of winging it. I think it's a matter of, for any, if you're looking for an honest
connection,
yeah. and an honest feedback and the most honest answer, if it's not rehearsed, it's much easier because this is the most honest and the most truthful answer or reaction that you'll get from me. And
great.
I think that is something that people connect with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you decide, did you ever have a different path that you were going to pursue?
No, never.
No. When you decide to do that, what was the disposition of your parents toward our daughter wants to become a cook or a chef?
My parents have been and still are extremely supportive.
From the minute
from
you told them that
the
was your...
From the minute that I told them that this is what I want to do. The only thing that my dad said was just do what you want to, but just make sure that you're the best at it. I mean, there is no space for mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that has and will always stay with me because then I keep on pushing myself to go ahead and work harder. Also, I mean, I grew up in this small town. I mean, this was a working town, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all the families, they really, really were concentrating on studying. The kids had to study. The kids were either studying to be doctors or engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're really thinking outside the box, maybe an accountant.
Right.
And over here, I mean, even over here in America, I mean, becoming a chef has become cool very recently. I mean,
relatively,
and,
yeah.
And in India, I mean, just imagine this. I'm talking about in 1992, 1993 I'm like, hey, I'll be a chef. In India, you didn't have female chefs. I mean, the chefs who were in the kitchens were not educated. It wasn't a part of it wasn't a career path.
Mm-hmm.
So for for my parents to have placed that faith in me,
mm-hmm.
I think that was a big gift, and that's why I think I push myself every
okay.
day.
So you went to, I'm not sure if I'm going to get this right. You went to a hospitality school?
Yes.
In India?
In hotel management.
Hotel
yeah.
management.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, why that instead of straight to some sort of a culinary program?
Because in India, we did not have any culinary programs
really?
Per se at that time.
So you just went you just started working.
Yes. So
okay.
if you really wanted to, not that you started working, if you wanted to be a chef, you would go ahead and do your entire hospitality training or your hotel management.
Mm-hmm.
You did your bachelor's in that. And then when you got a job, you could then go ahead and request that I want to be placed in the kitchen, in the front of the house, because the best kitchens at that time in India were in hotels because they could afford
right.
to have great ingredients and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So so that was pretty much the trajectory that I took.
Now, at what point in your young life did you set your sights on coming to the United States? Was that always part of the game plan?
I don't think it was an active part of the game plan. My sister came here to do her master's
in
engineering. Like, she did software
okay.
engineering. She went to IU. And I think that's the time that the bug kind of got settled in my mind.
Is that Indiana University?
Indiana University, uh-huh. yeah, Bloomington. So it was, I think that's the time when I started thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think halfway through my bachelor's, I asked one of my culinary instructors that which is the best culinary school in the entire world to go to. And without even batting an eyelid, he said the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. And that kind of made up make up my mind that this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, do whatever you want to, but make sure that you're best at it. And that was something that, like, okay, then I'll go to the best school.
Had you spent any time in this country?
Nope.
Your English was?
I went to a convent school.
Okay.
We had Irish nuns who were teaching us English, so you can imagine that. Elocution all the time.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So you come over. What? Just be totally frank.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Pretend no one's listening.
Right.
What are your first impressions when you come over here? Good, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. What struck you? What surprised you?
I grew up in India, where my entire perception of America was from Archie Comics. Right?
Archie Comics.
That's what we read, right? And okay. We were like, to me, Jughead was my hero because he would be eating burgers and having malt shakes at Pop Tates all the time.
Yeah.
So that is pretty much my perception of American cuisine, right? So I think there was a lot of excitement because we do have relatives over here, and every time they would come back, it was like this awesome, mystical, great country to go to. So the excitement was absolutely there. I do remember I landed in Chicago because my sister was working over there. December
so she was
of
out
98,
of school at this point.
She had just graduated.
Okay.
It was her first job. December of 98, Chicago. The week before I landed, she had just bought a car, and she practiced driving from Schaumburg to downtown so that she could show me downtown.
Okay.
And we land, and the first place that she takes me to is, lo and behold, I think it was Applebee's. And and we order a margarita, and that was my first exposure to the portion sizes in America. Like, they literally got a bucket of margarita, and I'm like, what
awesome.
Is this?
Yeah.
So
especially, that's also more true in some regions than others.
Yes.
And definitely true where you were. Yes. And I don't mean that as a dig. I'm just saying that's just a fact.
It's a fact.
Yeah.
So then we went to downtown Chicago, where at the Adler Planetarium, like, we, you know, it's got the most gorgeous views of downtown.
Yeah.
But it's also December. And we open the door, and I shut the door. I'm like, let's get out of here. Like, it's too cold. Like, I didn't know that humanly it was possible for this kind of cold.
Yeah. How cold did it get where you come from? Like, what would be really cold there?
This would be really cold there.
Like 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. I grew up in Florida, same
difference.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it was like, and that also, like, we would be having layers of sweaters and, oh my God, like, this is so cold. But
You probably felt like it was like the lunar surface or something.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Because you keep on, you're like, how cold will it be? Once you know, then you know exactly how to layer, and you know how to crack the code. But when you've never felt it, you really don't know what to expect. So that was and then when I remember driving to the CIA, my uncle and aunt, they drove me. They used to live in New Jersey, and they drove me to the CIA. And have you been there?
The CIA? Oh, many
times. So the Roth Hall, which is the main building.
The main administrative building.
Yeah.
And also the restaurants in there.
The
main restaurant.
The restaurants are in there. Yeah. The Apple Pie Bakery and all of that is over there.
Yeah, what is it? It's now the Bocuse room.
Bocuse room. It was this café. I remember, I still very distinctively, after all of this time, remember my first glimpse of Roth Hall. It was just like the feeling of pride, the feeling that I have finally arrived where I belonged. And that was, I mean, I still get goosebumps when I talk about it. It was just absolutely
amazing. So you felt the Cook's equivalent of like somebody going to like Oxford.
Absolutely.
Or Princeton.
Absolutely.
Or it felt like that. Like you would reach the mountaintop.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was just like, CIA was incredible. I jumped into everything.
Okay.
Everything. I was the tour guide. I was at the service desk. I volunteered. Any chef wanted help, I would volunteer. I was on the judiciary board. I mean, I was everywhere and anywhere, because to me, I thought that I had been given this incredible gift and I couldn't squander it.
Who was Tim Ryan in charge at that point, or was it still Metz?
No, it was Metz.
It was still Ferdinand Metz. This may be the first time his name has ever come up on the show, but he was the president of the school largely credited with sort of bringing that school from what would be considered basically a trade school to a school. He was there in the late 70s and into the 80s and 90s, and he kind of brought it up to like a place where someone with aspirations
absolutely
of becoming a chef in a more in a more ambitious way would want to go.
And he also, I think, he gave a lot of he was responsible for giving a lot of credence to this entire industry. I mean, the fact that, you know, the CMC exams used to be held over there. I mean, they were like, you know, certified master chefs, certified master bakers.
Yeah.
I mean, these were pinnacle of of what it is to be a chef.
Yeah.
And I think that was something absolutely commendable.
So this has changed in the last several years at this point, in that there are now, I mean, there are now classes there in all kinds of different cuisines. There's classes there in brewing beer. I mean, there's all kinds of things there now. When you were there, it was still largely a French-based curriculum, I believe. No?
I did baking and pastry arts. I never did culinary.
Oh, you didn't do culinary?
No, I did not.
I did not realize that. Okay.
Yeah. And then I moved over to the dark side.
What's the dark side?
Became culinary.
Okay.
Just kidding.
You mean in your working life?
In my working life.
No. Why did you go to pastry? Do you thought you were going to be strictly?
No. So, again, I grew up in India. So, to me, I grew up in India. Who wants to learn Indian food? Right? I wanted to learn something which nobody was doing over there, which was pretty much pastries. I mean, French pastries and stuff. They were at a very rudimentary level in India. So to me, I had never, even when I came here to go to school, it wasn't decided that I was going to stay here or if I was going to go back. And and I literally, I mean, that's what I wanted to do. I mean, bake cakes and, you know, just make these gorgeous structures and all of, you know, everything which was right and beautiful about pastries.
Got it.
So till date, pastries, I mean, has a very special place
in my
heart.
Oh, you're actually touching your heart as you say this.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You, but the you answered, it was actually not a different, you know, it was a different side of the menu, but it was, that is the question I was going to ask, which was, did that style of food resonate with you? You know, because it was not the food you grew up on. That's what I was going to say, right? But that you just said it was French pastry. It was French,
yes.
Right?
So, it was very French oriented.
Really, yes, and that appealed to you.
It was different. It was different. It fascinated me. But I have got to tell you, the funniest thing was that. So whatever we make in the kitchens, I mean, we eat it, right?
Yeah.
So if. Somebody is doing, like, you know, basic culinary, whatever they would make, salads and stuff, you know, we would go stand in line, we would get the food, take it to the cafeteria and eat it. I remember for a good part of a year, I would be eating salads with Tabasco in it because I'm like, this has no flavor. Mm-hmm. And my batchmates would be constantly pulling my leg about it because they're like, oh my God, Manit, like you should find the heir to the Tabasco like empire and get married to him because then you can eat this all the time. So it was hilarious. But that was, to me, I was like, there's no flavor in this.
Which for you meant some degree of heat.
It meant some degree of heat at that time. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know what's funny? When I was in college,
right,
in the dining hall,
right,
everything was I thought everything was bland. I mean, I grew up loving spicy food.
Exactly.
And I still, to this day, actually, when I make mac and cheese, the breading I put on top, it's breadcrumb, parm, and coarsely ground black pepper.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Because I used to put tons of black pepper on my macaroni so I could taste it.
Taste it.
Yeah.
So true.
Yeah.
So
which is
true.
Maybe a little gross, but...
No, not at all.
Yeah, it's. I mean, what I do with it now,
please,
is fine.
Please, I would be putting Tabasco on it.
Tabasco on a salad,
exactly.
Right. Yeah, what I did was a minor offense. Okay. So take me through it. Where do you work when you get out of school?
Oh, my God.
First of all, why do you decide to stay?
Because I decided to stay because I saw the opportunity and the difference, right? There still is a lot of conversation going on right now about being a woman and, you know, in the culinary industry. And imagine, this is in America. This is one of the most progressive countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine in India what would have been the situation? I had worked for a couple of months before I came to the CIA because I had some, you know, I graduated in June and then I joined CIA in December.
Mm.
So I had a couple of months in between. So I'm like, I'm going to work. And I got a great glimpse of what it was to work in the kitchen in India. And it was... To me, I just thought that I would be putting all my effort and all my resources into just fighting with everybody to tell them that I belonged, Because even when I was working over there, it was the constantly, "Madam, you are 18 years old. Shouldn't you be married by now?" And I'm like, "What the?" You know. And the first
did
time
you
I was
just
here,
actually do an Indian accent as
I
you
did.
As you you
I,
went
I
up
did.
You went up a
I
you went up a notch.
I absolutely did. Okay. I absolutely did. And my daughter does that to me all the time. I'm like, "I do not talk like that."
That she imitates you.
She imitates
the way you
me.
Just imitated this antagonist back home.
Exactly. Okay. And yeah, I know. I can do it and get
away
with it.
You're allowed to
absolutely.
Do it. No, I know. I could do it. I could do it on Yiddish person if I wanted to.
So, right. But it was interesting because then I would turn to them and I was like, the first time I would hear, the second time I would hear, the third time I was like, "Why do you know a good boy that I should talk to my parents about?" And they're like, "Oh my God, she's too smart for her own good." Mm-hmm. So there was a no-win situation over there. And I realized that whatever, I knew that it wasn't going to be easy over here too, but I knew that maybe my effort would go a longer way over here as opposed to India.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, let's try it. And again, I knew it wouldn't be easy because I graduated on the top, you know, at the top of my class. All the 3 awards for my class, I got all of them. So I'm like, yeah, great, I've got it made. And then reality really, really stuck in because I started applying for jobs.
Where? Well, I mean, what city? Not the names of the restaurants.
Anywhere. I applied in New York. I applied in Chicago. I applied in Miami. I applied in San Francisco. Wherever I could get connections. The chefs were amazing. They were connecting me. But I had come here on a student visa.
Mm.
And at that time, it was very easy. For people in the technical field, like being an engineer and stuff, to get their, you know, paperwork sponsored. But it was impossible for somebody as a chef to get sponsorship. Like, I got, right now when I sit and I think about, like, I got job offers from some of the most iconic chefs in this country. And as soon as I mentioned my paperwork, they're like, "We would love to, but we're just not equipped to handle that." So
don't you have to, am I right, that they would have to show, when they have to demonstrate some compelling, what are they, there's a term for it.
They have to show that there's nobody else can, who
yes,
can do this.
Yes, that
job.
You were
absolutely.
Like uniquely, I forget, but there's a term,
yeah.
Right? Then that's a challenge.
And that, I think, was one of the first steps as to why I decided to get into the Indian aspect of things.
Mm.
Because I'm like, I am, and when I did my hotel management, I was like, in terms of culinary, I was classically trained. Like, mm-hmm. You know, we needed to know, you know, the Larousse gastronomic from A to Z.
Yeah.
We needed to. So all of that, I was classically trained. So I decided at that time that I was going to use my foundation in French, my, you know, I don't know if I can use the word smarts, but the knowledge, especially in terms of work ethics and working in this country, what I learned from CIA and what I was born with, right?
Which is what?
And this face, in the sense that it's Indian.
Okay.
I am quintessentially Indian.
Okay,
that's
what you mean.
It's very tough for people to look at me and say that, okay, especially in 2000, that, okay, Manit, let's make some incredible French food.
Right.
I realized that was very difficult. So I'm like, I know what my strong points are and how am I going to use them to my advantage. So at that time, my uncle and aunt who were in New Jersey were opening an Indian restaurant. And that's the last thing I wanted to do. I'm like, I graduated from the best school in India and from the best school in the world at CIA. I don't want to open an Indian restaurant.
In New Jersey?
In New Jersey, which was
in such a slap at New Jersey, even coming from India. You didn't want to go there.
But this was like, this was in Cherry Hill, so it was a stone's throw from Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's a ritzy area.
Yeah, but it was incredible because that pretty much was my training ground.
Mm-hmm.
I not only learned, I was 24 at that time, and I was managing an entire team because I was not only doing the kitchen, I was also doing the front. Such valuable such valuable training and experience I got. So we were like a 70-seater upscale restaurant. We expanded to 140-seater overlooking, you know, the Cooper River, and then we started doing a lot of banquets. A lot I had to learn as I was on the job, as I was running from point A to point B. I was learning, I was figuring out how to do things. There are times that I wish that I had a mentor who would have like literally taken my hands and taught me to do that. But what I learned by myself is something that I don't think any mentor could have taught me. So that, I think, was very incredible.
You have made several references to being a woman in the industry.
Yeah.
You strike me as metabolically confident. You strike me as someone who showed up in the world pretty confident. Is that accurate?
No, that's not accurate.
It's not accurate.
No, it's not accurate. Like I was telling you, I've always loved to connect and talk to people.
Yeah.
But, I mean, imagine you're in a small city, grown up, you've gone to an all-girls school till the 10th grade. If you're talking, I mean, this is a small community. I mean, there is everybody's like,
right.
Her daughter, his son, they both were talking. Right? But you grow up in this society, so it affects you. So I remember my dad, he was an HR director, and he would be giving presentations in front of thousands and thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I just asked him, I'm like, how do you do it? Aren't you like nervous? Like, I would be nervous just standing in front of a class and introducing myself, right? And he's like, back to the drama queen. He's like, you know what? Like, you're acting like, you know, a drama queen all the time. He's like, just stand up and pretend that you are acting. Pretend that you're acting to be the most confident person in the room.
Right.
And give it some time and it'll naturally come to you. So it is something I had to work on.
But I mean, now it's natural.
Oh, yeah. Now it's fun. Now it's not,
right.
I think it also comes with age, that you reach that stage where you're like, you know that you don't have to prove yourself.
Mm.
The only person you have to prove yourself to is yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, and you realize that once you do that, you just form the most incredible bonds and the most incredible conversations with people, because you're not there trying to impress someone.
Yeah.
You're not there trying to prove somebody who you're not.
Yeah, it's like a state of grace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This
you
is
just,
who you
you're
are.
On the other, you're, you,
absolutely.
Yeah, you come to another place.
Yeah. And I think that is, and it is, again, like, people are like, how are you so confident? I'm like, I wasn't born that way.
Okay. So I'm not the first person to make that mistake.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, I'm like, you have to grow yourself. I mean, you have to be confident in who you are, and you grow into it.
So when you start that job in that restaurant, how you said 70 seats and then you grew it to a larger number. How much staff? Roughly.
The kitchen had 6 people.
Oh, pretty small.
It was small. And the front of the house had, I think, another 6.
Oh, okay.
And I was responsible for all of them. And then, of course, when we were doing banquets, we would be hiring, temporary.
Sure.
So, when,
were you fairly comfortable in that environment as the leader? Or was that something you had to grow into?
I think that came very naturally.
Because why? Because you knew that you knew what you were doing?
I think so. I think it was because I knew what I was doing. I also knew that what vision I had, and also the fact that I had a big free hand in taking that organization to whatever direction that we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So I think absolutely.
Okay. So when do you decide to move on from that?
So I think around 4 or 5 years in, she still is in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and I reached that stage where I'm like, I need to explore more. So I used to have this silver Mazda Miata. I literally wrapped up everything and I drove to Chicago, you know, and I think that is one of the most incredible part about being young, and that's what I keep on telling, you know, young chefs, that just take the risk, go out, explore the world. You never know what opportunities you will get.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. I just drove to Chicago. Nothing, I mean, I did have, you know, my sister was there, so that was an incredible support system. But I just drove over there, and then, you know, went from one restaurant to the other. There was a really a cool Indian fusion restaurant over there, which I went and staged with, and then through word of mouth, there was another restaurant which was opening up, and they were looking for a chef. And I just kept on taking one chance after the other, mm-hmm. after the other, yeah. So that was it.
How did you find Chicago?
I love Chicago. I consider Chicago was the first place that I landed when I came from India, mm-hmm. and my sister's over there, so I always consider Chicago as home base.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, okay. You know, like when you go to your parents' house,
yeah.
to me, in America, it's like that.
That's your American home
that's
base.
That's my American home base.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. How long were you there all in?
5-6 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's sort of your time frame.
Yeah. Yeah. No, please don't say that. I've just reached that threshold in Nashville.
Okay. So, yeah.
Who knows? Who knows?
I smell a move coming on.
Who knows? Who knows? I think that's the one thing that we've realized is that we take life as it comes.
Yeah.
I mean, if you become too rigid that, oh, I'm never moving out from New York, or I'm never moving out, you know, no matter how much you will dig your heels
yes.
in, the tide will come and take you where you have to. So just, like, flow with it and make the best of it.
So you start making a name for yourself in Chicago.
Yeah.
What's the name of the restaurant?
It was Vermilion.
Yes.
Yeah.
You got great reviews.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. And what was your style like at that restaurant?
You know, at that time, the owner of the place, they wanted a Latin and an Indian fusion because they thought that it just had so much of commonality in it. And I remember when I went to do my trade test, so to speak, I was able to translate their vision on a plate most successfully. So, yeah, so that's what I was doing at that time.
What was your level of familiarity with, I mean, here we go again, right, with the overgeneralization, Latin cuisine, I mean.
Not much.
No, but that's even, what is that? I mean, that's,
Latin can
there's
be
so
anything.
Many countries
yeah.
that fall under that umbrella.
Mexico, you can go to, we used to have this.
Cuba?
We used to have Brazil, we had
yeah.
Peru, we had Mexico. I think that was incredible because there was so much that you could play with.
So you pulled influences from all those places.
From all those places.
And do you agree, I guess you must have, if you were able to do it successfully, did you agreed that there were commonalities?
Absolutely.
What would those be to you?
I mean, things that were, spices, cilantro, coriander, again, mm-hmm. very popular in Indian cuisine, mm-hmm. and you see that coriander, which is called cilantro, like mm-hmm. coriander
sure.
leaves
yeah.
or cilantro
yeah.
leaves, mango, coconut, papaya, I mean, like,
okay.
beans. The more I delved into different regions, the more I'm like, huh. Okay, this is
right.
so interesting. So, yeah, it was a lot of research. It was definitely nothing that came instinctively to me. And it was everybody, our owners, they would travel to Latin America very often.
Yeah.
So they would come back with menus and, you know,
yeah.
like, okay, look at this. This is from Brazil. This is from Peru. This is from so-and-so. So, I mean, it was constant research.
Was it fun?
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the one thing which I've realized, that whatever said and done, whatever situation I'll find myself in, I will have fun.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But serious fun.
Serious fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you know, if you're having fun, again, I mean, your audience knows it. Your
right.
audience knows it through the plate or through you going and meeting
yeah.
them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what brings you to Nashville?
Oh, my God. Oh, so after Chicago, Vermilion opened an outpost over here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved to New York over mm-hmm. here. And I think around that time I found out that I was expecting baby number one.
Okay.
So I was like, you know what, let's figure it out. Let's take a step back. And, I started my own business, which was a consulting. Chopped had just started off at that time. I wrote my first book. Decided to travel the entire country. We did, like, you know, in the bus for the bus for
book
the
tour?
Tour. Oh yeah.
Did you enjoy that process?
Other than the restrooms on the bus, everything else was a lot of fun.
Okay.
Absolutely. But it was
okay.
it was incredible because we got to meet people and it was just eye-opening as to the reach that Chopped had and, mm-hmm. and still has. And around that time, we started getting a lot of calls. We, as in my husband Vivek, he also is, I mean, we did our undergrad in India together.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we connected and he went to England to the University of Bournemouth to do his master's while I came here to the CIA. And it was really interesting because we were getting these phone calls from all over, like, would you like to open something in San Francisco, in Seattle, in New York, here, blah, blah, blah. And in between, I get a phone call, would you like to open something in Nashville? And my first reaction was, who the beep goes to Nashville? Because I had never been there. You have this mm-hmm. perception, you're in the food mecca of the world, New York. Why would you move out of New York? You've worked all your life to get here. And Vivek and I, we're also business partners. So we explore each and every opportunity that mm-hmm. comes our way. And so we went to Nashville to explore what was available. And we fell in love with the city, not only with the people, but the business opportunity that the city offered us. I mean, there was nothing like what we were planning mm-hmm. to do. I mean, we, you know, an Indian ale house is what we were planning mm-hmm. to do. Nothing of that sort was over there. We were meeting people and they were clamoring for something which was beyond hot chicken. They wanted some more flavor. They wanted something more, you know, diverse and mm-hmm. ethnic and global. They also, I mean, the largest convention center in the South was about to open in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there were insane number of people moving over there. New York had started sitting up and noticing Nashville as a food town.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot which was going on. And we were like, okay. So the plan was, I was calling myself a Nash Yorker for a very long time because
a what?
A Nash Yorker.
Okay.
Because, you know, we were planning to live in New York and Vivek right. had a couple of businesses over here and commute.
Yeah.
Best laid plans. The project took a really long time to open because mm-hmm. the building that we decided on was an old building and and it's the South. Everything takes some time. Along the way, we found out we were expecting baby number two.
Okay.
The day we opened the restaurant, November 18, 2014, baby number two decided to be born 3 months early.
3 months?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was a 26-weeker, and it was stayed in the NICU for 3 months.
Yeah.
We named him Karma because you need to have a sense of humor for this. And I think that was the time that we decided, because we were living in a hotel with a three-year-old. It was just like one of the toughest times in your life.
Oh my
because
gosh.
It's not only physically you go through, I mean, such a, you know, huge surgery,
yeah.
and then you have, like, you know, you never know,
yeah.
you
we
know
have
what happened.
Just for people who don't know, our twins were premature by 7 weeks, so you were 50% even more than that. I'm not going to get personal about details, but I will just say that the smaller of our two children was 3 pounds, 13 ounces at birth. And NICU, for people who don't know, is the intensive care unit. It's the natal intensive
neonatal,
care,
yeah.
neonatal, right? So
yeah.
for newborns, it's a
yeah.
special place. And that's amazing. That's
yeah. Karma was 2.5 pounder.
He oh
was
my
lighter
gosh!
Than a, I mean,
you, smaller than your hand.
Smaller than my
yeah.
hand and lighter than a gallon of milk.
Yeah.
As I tell people.
Yeah.
But then, hey, what doesn't break you makes you stronger.
Correct.
And that's what
yeah.
it was. Like
yes.
to me, I was like, I mean, I've always been an annoyingly positive person.
Mm-hmm.
But after this, I think I pushed myself more because I strongly believe that what you send out in the world comes back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm going to see the bright side in everything. And that's what I did. I'm like, okay. So we moved to Nashville, and I think it was the best move ever because we've lived there for over 4 years. In 4 years, we've opened 4 restaurants. We have 2 breweries. We continue to grow. The kids go to school there. soon they'll have a southern accent, y'all. And we'll just...
Is that strange for you?
No. I mean, let them be whoever they are. I mean, it's, you know. Yeah.
But they'll be polite. They'll say sir and ma'am. Yes, they 100% will.
We are so particular about that.
Yeah, yeah.
If my daughter is like, you know, Allie, excuse me, Miss Allie, good.
Yes.
So, absolutely. So that's, that's what
How is Karma?
He's doing great. Good. He is 4.5 and he's going to be he's going to be taller than me.
Yeah,
he'll be
well, I will tell
him.
You that our son, who was the one who was 3 pounds, 13 ounces,
right.
is already taller than my wife at age 14.
Oh, my God.
He's a beast. Oh, he's an absolute beast.
It is. Knockwood.
Yeah.
It's like what the doctors and the nurses do in the NICU is just such a miracle.
There are NICUs and hospice are the miracle workers that I've experienced in my life. Just the best people.
Amazing.
Yeah. The only upside to all that is, well, you already had baby number one.
Yes.
We had twins. They taught us everything.
Oh, my God.
Because we were there for 3 weeks.
Wow.
So they taught us how to do a bath.
Yeah.
They taught us how to swaddle. They taught us how to...
Oh, my God.
By the time we got the kids home, there was no acclimation.
You were trained.
Yeah, we were trained.
You were trained well.
Yeah. Yeah, while they were saving other, while they were, like, in triage with people.
Oh, my
God. It was amazing.
It was amazing, yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about the show.
Which one?
Tell me about Chopped.
Chopped.
Yeah. How did it come into your life?
I was invited to do Iron Chef.
Mm-hmm.
I went against Chef Morimoto.
Okay.
In which I came second among two people. So from there, they invited me to compete on the next Iron Chef.
Yeah.
That was the same season that Mark Forgione and, he won.
Yes. Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Yes.
You said you came in second out of two people.
Yes.
Now, we haven't talked about the word competitive.
Right.
Okay. You obviously take everything you do seriously. So you're laughing about it now.
Right.
But when you lost, did you take it hard?
Of course I took it hard.
Okay.
I mean, we are chefs.
Yeah. Had you, trained for that event?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. How did one train for Iron Chef?
Oh, God. We would, on days off, we would be in the kitchen. We would time. We would have people who would give us secret ingredients. And then we would be like, okay, your time starts now. And we were hardcore. We were practicing hardcore.
So you were... Did it take a while to get over it? Was there a sting?
Of course there was a sting. Yeah. I mean, there still is a sting, right?
Really?
But
okay.
No, but also, I mean, for me to have thought that I could have beaten Morimoto at that time, which is close to around 10 years back, was very arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on. He's one of the original Iron Chefs, and he's been he pretty much started his career the year that I was born. So to expect that from myself was very arrogant.
Okay.
But then that's fine. We are chefs. We are arrogant. That's
okay.
What we are. So yeah, then I competed on the next Iron Chef.
Yes.
Around that time, Chopped had just started.
Mm-hmm.
So they invited me to be a guest judge. And the next year, they invited me to be a permanent judge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's been around 9-10 years. Yeah. So that's how it came about.
Yeah, that show just keeps chugging along.
It's amazing. I can't even tell you. I meet so many people who are they tell me that that's the one show that they can sit with their kids, they can sit with their grandparents.
Right.
Everybody can sit and see that.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks you in.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that the format is the same.
Yeah.
But every time, because of the people, the storyline is completely
mm-hmm.
different. It's like the producers, the creators, I mean, they created a phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Chopped is. And I feel so grateful to be a part of it.
Well, there's also, how many judges are in rotation?
There are nine of us permanent judges.
Yeah.
And then we're constantly getting guest judges.
Yeah, So that keeps it fresh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the permutation combination. You hardly get the same three judges. So it's fun. And all of us have a very quirky equation with each other. So
yeah.
it it keeps it very fun.
You guys, you all seem to really get on with each other.
We do. I think the foundation of it is that there is mutual respect. We realize that each and every person gets a very unique perception to the table. We do have arguments. We do have, you know, our opinions that we share. But those arguments and opinions never mean that the other person's opinion is not valid or not strong enough. So and then of course, I mean, it's been 10 years. Like, we are like siblings. We are constantly pulling each other's leg, and it's fun. It's really fun to be. And that's not only what you guys see in front.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's the entire team behind, you know.
There are nights where I've been out to dinner in the city and run into, you know, some of the gang.
Right.
You know, out together or at book launch events together.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's fun.
I mean, I'm lucky to know. So it's a nice crowd.
It's a nice crowd.
Yeah. So let me ask you. You were talking about your initial thought about Nashville. You know, like, to me, you know, like, knowing that you live there. And I grew up, it's not really the South, but I grew up in Florida, South Florida.
It is the South.
Geographically it is, but it's not really, Miami's not really the South. Not in the way people think of the South.
No.
And, you know, when I think of somebody, as you said, you know, you said this face, right? Like, when I think of somebody who is clearly,
a fish out of water?
A little bit, or however you want to put it. Moving to a place, and this is probably my own myopia, right?
Right.
I think that has got to be, that's got to be tough, I would think. But then I think, is that just outdated?
Not really. At least not in Nashville. It still is. I think Nashville is a very, has a very diverse group of people who live there.
Yeah.
Nashville also is, I mean, it's got a big Nissan headquarters, so there are people from all over the world who come and work over there. The music city, you know, the music being such an integral part. So I have never felt, felt as an outsider in Nashville.
Interesting.
On the contrary, people, just because of the entire Southern charm, people have just, they've hugged us.
Yeah.
They have, you know, the amount of love that we received, especially after Karma was born. Like, you know, they were like, oh, he wants to be a Nashvillian. Okay,
yeah.
So we're going to go ahead and make sure that, you know, he's one of us and you are one of us. So it's been an incredible city for that.
That's
never
great.
Yeah, we've never ever felt that. And at times I do feel that maybe we get a little bit more of the special attention because of, you know, being on a national stage. But hey, I'll take it. So we have four concepts at the present moment. The original one is Chauhan Ale and Masala House, which was the first one to open. That has always received a lot of accolades, and people have been always very kind. And then in the second year, we started talking, and we were like, people were like, we need a good Chinese restaurant in Nashville, because the best one was P.F. Chang's. So we're like, okay. So we opened a Chinese restaurant called Tan So.
How'd you go about doing that?
We absolutely got a lot of people to consult, to train. I mean, I am not a Chinese chef. That's not something that I've grown up with. So just get people who are expertise at it. And I think that is what has really helped. Then we came, like, two of our colleagues from Chicago, Mikey and Brian, they were doing these amazing pop-up restaurants in Chicago, and we met them, and we were like, hey, move to Nashville, we'll open a restaurant for you. So that's what happened. They moved to Nashville, and then came around Mockingbird. And then finally, Chatterbull, which is like that space, came available to us, and we are like, "Ha, what do we do?" And then we open an Indian street concept, Chatterbull. All of them are doing, knock wood, very well. So again, lots to be grateful about.
How big of a team do you two have?
Oh my God, we have.
I mean, you have the restaurants, but do you have a management group?
We do have a management group. It's called MORF.
Yeah.
Vivek is the CEO. I'm the president. We have CFO and directors of operation, etc. So we have a management team who manages all of these concepts.
Yeah.
Our total staff strength is around over 200.
Yeah.
And we started off with around 20, so it's
amazing.
It's a good place, yeah.
Do you enjoy you wouldn't keep doing it? Multiple concepts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
To me, it's not only like my favorite part of whatever I do is interacting with people. So not only is it interacting with the guests, but my team. Because it's incredible how they come up with the most creative of ideas and how we go about it. And I think all of those things just make up for a stronger team. Like, I strongly believe that a rising tide raises all ships.
Mm-hmm.
So like in Chatable, a lot of the people who've been with us for some time,
mm-hmm.
we gave them sweat equity. We are like, you know what? You're putting your heart and soul in it. You deserve to be, a part of the ownership of this.
Yeah.
So
that also keeps them in the fold, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, it's funny. Years ago, a friend of mine, I can't say who or what the company was, but fairly decent-sized company here in New York, and this person was the corporate chef and, kept an eye on, maybe a handful of places or six places, something like that, and took a job, left town. They were so angry after years, the owners, they booted them that day, right? They didn't even want them to transition.
Wow.
And they never made them, they never gave them a piece of the action. And this person was running a restaurant group for them.
And we have, Vivek and I, we've been on the other side.
Yeah.
Where you think that you've put in your heart and soul and it's not acknowledged. A lot of it has to be, it's also motivation, it's also pride. I see the way people, they get their family in and say that, hey, come to my restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, to Vivek and me, we're like, yeah, that's fine if you're getting a smaller piece of the pie. It doesn't make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the bigger scheme of things, we are going to grow if the people along with us grow.
Oh, sure.
And that's important.
Do you, I want to ask this the right way. Is there a unifying or umbrella? And the answer just might be no. But is there a way you think about yourself at this point that goes beyond or in addition to chef? In other words, you very much strike me as an entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
Seem like you have the entrepreneur gene.
I think myself, I think we've worked so hard that now I think myself as a part of the business, in
mm-hmm.
the sense that I am a brand which my marketing team is selling.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, there'll be people who'll come in, right? There are some incredible chefs. I mean, nowadays, chef is a very small aspect of what I do. I consider myself doing only
mm-hmm.
because I have a team who is doing that,
mm-hmm.
right? They do their research. They know what we are doing.
Mm-hmm.
We cook. As much as I would love to be on the line every day, I hardly get the opportunity to do that just
mm-hmm.
because there's everything else around,
yeah.
right? I am the face, and that is what brings people in. So there is there are pieces of a puzzle
mm-hmm.
to make that entire puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have each and every piece in place.
Mm-hmm.
I am a small part of that piece,
mm-hmm.
right? Then there is the chef, then there's the marketing team,
mm-hmm.
then there's the PR team, then there is the CFO, the CEO,
mm-hmm.
Each and every, the dishwasher. Each and every piece needs to be there
mm-hmm.
to make an entire picture.
Yeah.
So I consider myself just a small piece of that.
But when you say you're the brand, right, and other and the whole that affects
right.
everything, right, that draws people to the restaurants, that means you have to
for the first time, and then if the rest of the team can't follow through, that's it.
100%.
Right.
But what I was going to ask was, is it difficult for you Or has it been something you've had to develop? Do you have to develop an ability to think of yourself almost in the third person, from outside yourself, to see you know,
That's an awesome observation. Absolutely.
What's that like?
I think it's pretty much started off with the Chauhan Ale and Masala House.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they used, like, we decided to use my last name, right? So it was, it's really funny when people, like, initially they would be like, let's go to Chauhan, and I would be like, oh, that's my name. Then I'm like, no, that's a restaurant.
Yeah.
I think that really helped, because then I could kind of, that's Chauhan, that's an entity, you know. It's not me. I am a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the first step. You have to constantly look at it. I mean, especially when we're doing marketing meetings and PR meetings, you know, we are having these conversations where, you know, for example, the PR team, right? They are representing this restaurant, this restaurant, this restaurant, and Manit, right? Which is, you know, so that's a restaurant. Right. So there are times we're having this conversation, and I'm like, and like the conversation starts as being a third person.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, initially I would be like, hey guys, you know what? I'm here.
Yeah.
But it's so funny how the transition has happened, that now when we are having these conversations, I am like, I said, so Manit is going to go there. And I'm like, no. I am going to go there.
Yeah.
You have to. Otherwise it can go to your head very easily.
That's
very easily.
Yeah.
And you have to have, and as soon as it goes to your head, that's it. That's the beginning
game
of the
game over.
End.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of the end.
Yeah. Have you ever had a moment where it did go to your head, or do you feel like you've been able to always keep it kind of in perspective?
Life has a way that anytime things go to my head, it just makes me fall straight on my face. So I have realized that if it goes to my head,
you course correct pretty fast.
Yeah, because I'm like, I'm going to fall on my face right now if I don't stop this. So, I mean, you realize that this is just a phase. You know that this is going to go.
Yeah.
And you just have to maximize it. I mean, for you and the people around you, and that's it. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. Well, it was great meeting you.
Oh my God, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for sitting. We got a little busy around us here.
thanks
for rolling with it. And, you know, all the best with everything you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
This episode is presented by The Brooklyn Kitchen, a recreational cooking school on a mission to change the world by teaching people how to cook like grown-ups. The Brooklyn Kitchen began in 2006 when two creative home chefs, Taylor Erkinen and Harry Rosenblum, recognized an opportunity to create a community space with approachable, hands-on cooking classes and inventive culinary experiences. Taylor and Harry believe that cooking is a daily practice in creative problem-solving. They bring this ethos to the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking school that fosters community and redefines home cooking for everyone. Now located at Sunset Park's Industry City, the Brooklyn Kitchen hosts a range of public and private cooking classes, corporate team parties, pop-up dinners, and tasting events for cooks of all levels. Learn more at thebrooklynkitchen.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Damon Bolte.
And I'm Souther Teague.
Together we host The Speakeasy, a show where we discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe.
Yeah, our guests range from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, hippies and homebrewers, and every expert enthusiast in between.
Browse episodes of The Speakeasy wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Manit Chauhan. I love doing it. And it was a funny scene, I should mention. I actually interviewed Andy Little first last week. It was Andy's birthday. And since they both operate in the town of Nashville, when Manit showed up, it was like a homecoming. The two of them, you know, it was a big hug. She knew it was his birthday. She wished him a happy birthday. They actually took the pictures of me and each of them that appear on the show page, because there was no one else in the restaurant available to do that for us. So they were very gracious about that. It was kind of nice having this little Nashville enclave momentarily at the Mermaid Inn when we did this. In any event, Andy Little First of all, I have to say, once in a while, we have a guest on the show who is a listener to the show, and Andy was very familiar with the show, which is always nice. He grew up in, I guess, what we would call Pennsylvania Dutch country, and worked at a lot of places in the Northeast, most prominently Patrick O'Connell's landmark restaurant, The Inn at Little Washington. And for the last 5 years, he has had his own place, Josephine Restaurant, in Nashville, Tennessee. The interview is self-explanatory. Again, since it's a kind of a long show this week, I'm going to get right to it. So here you go, my interview with Chef Andy Little of Josephine Restaurant, recorded last week at the Mermaid Inn. Here you go. Well, first of all, what's it like when you come back to New York? You grew up in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
We call it what? Pennsylvania Dutch country?
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that mean? I mean, I start picturing, my family was from Pennsylvania, but yeah. I just start picturing like the Amish.
So that's part of it for sure. And I
like Lancaster County.
Right. If you picture rolling hills and agrarian culture, then you're certainly in the right direction.
Farm stands.
Sure. Yeah. But just confining it to the Amish or Mennonite is a small percentage of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a lot of people moved and settled in that area from Germany, from Alsace, that area of Europe, because the agriculture, the land was similar. It was great farmland.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first thing that people think of is they think of the starch black hat and that definitely is part of it. Then, unfortunately, too, they think of the buffets and the smorgasbords and the
right.
everything that has become Lancaster County bus tour.
Tourist right. stuff.
And I think if there's an unfortunate nature to any of it, that might be it.
Yeah.
It is something that, very home-based, very agrarian, and wholesome food.
Yeah.
But when you put it in a steam table, I don't care what it is.
Yeah.
Put it in a steam table, you're degrading.
It's going to suffer.
It was,
yeah. Right? And you're going to suffer.
For sure. And the whole the culture itself. I mean, because it is, there are Amish people and there are Mennonite people, not exactly the biggest natural cheerleaders.
Yeah.
And so it's it was kind of left to be what it is. But growing up, it was just the food that I was around.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the food that I grew up with. It's certainly the older that I've gotten, the more I've been cooking, the more I'm looking for perspective in what I do and even places I eat. I think that when you go places and there is a clear perspective and they're looking through a very clear glass, it shows.
Yeah.
And so for me, I didn't know. I grew up, we were eating good food.
Yeah.
And
what town did you grow up in?
Hanover.
Okay. What was that like?
Snack Town, USA.
Meaning what?
We have Snyder's Pretzels is there. Utz Potato Chips is there.
Oh, gosh. Utz's Potato Chips?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So if you're eating pretzels or potato chips, they probably came from where I grew up.
Okay.
And that was it was a great place to live. It was a great place to grow up. But I didn't know any different. I mean, the first things that I started to really explore, I remember buying the Magnolia Grill cookbook with Ben Barker and his wife, who had just passed away. And so I really started looking at Southern food. That was going to be the Southern food is really interesting. I wanted to read a lot about it. And it wasn't until later that I really came back to, what about this food that I grew up with and in this beautiful area? I mean, anytime that I talk to people who have either been through central Pennsylvania or grew up there or vacationing there or just driving through to get to New York or to get to somewhere else, they always talk about how beautiful it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's absolutely true. I mean, I'm a little biased. I grew up there. But also, it's one of those things when you go away and come back, you really realize
it hits you anew.
How great it was, you know, and how beautiful it is. And, I mean, just look at some of the, I walked through Union Square Green Market this morning. Well, a lot of those farmers are coming from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's funny. I just walked there on the way to meet you.
Yeah.
Through there. Yeah.
So, great tomatoes, not right now, but, when they're in season, a lot of that is coming from Pennsylvania, and if you go, say you go to the DuPont Circle Farmers Market in D.C., same thing.
Yeah.
A lot of the great produce that's coming into our, you know, great cities is coming from central Pennsylvania. Yeah. So,
growing up, both your parents were teachers. Is that correct? At what level, or what did they teach? Like, what age did they teach?
At this point, I think you're probably going to want to give me a hug.
Don't tell me they were like psychology teachers or something like that.
No, it might even be worse than that.
Wow. Okay.
So my mom, for over 20 years, taught special ed, and then she went to teach sixth grade.
Okay.
And my dad taught fifth grade and was my fifth grade teacher.
Oh, God.
And then when I went to sixth grade, the position opened up to be the middle school principal in the school district. So he was my middle school principal from sixth through eighth grade.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So they weren't psychologists, but I probably feel like maybe there should be some therapy for me.
That's crazy. What was it like? I mean, okay, one class I can sort of – I think I had – once or twice as a kid, someone whose parent was like the teacher.
Yeah.
Okay. But the principal.
Yeah. You know, it was, it was great. It really was.
It was.
But as a kid, you know, if you get in trouble at school, you get in trouble at home. I mean, there's no, the dog ate my homework or, oh yeah, today was fine. I didn't get in trouble at all for throwing water balloons on one of the teachers from the second floor.
Mm-hmm.
It was, pretty swift. But it was, you know, I look back on growing up and, you know, people have asked me before, do you wish that you had started cooking at a much younger age?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't. The thing that I really think informs, more from a kitchen management standpoint and culture and restaurant management standpoint, is being able to sit around the table with my parents every night and listen to them talk about teaching kids and how they, you know, the things that they went through with, you know, if you have a class of 24 kids, you have 24 different personalities, you have different speeds at which people learn. And what I just said could entirely be transferred to the restaurant business.
100%.
Too.
Sure.
You know, you have all these different personalities that you have to manage. You know, if you're a personality A on Tuesday, you might be personality C on Friday.
Sure.
Your learning speed is the same, but managing how people learn and how they work in an environment, learning that from my parents was very valuable.
So you kind of picked it up by osmosis.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where the kid goes into the family business.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's actually how I got into cooking was I was going to go back to school and get my teaching certification in order to pay to do that. I started to work in restaurants.
Got it. But before we talk about that, you were at one point, if I'm not mistaken, headed down a music path. You look very nostalgic.
No,
when I say
it's
you brightened.
I was a tuba player.
Mm-hmm.
And in high school, you know, I played the cello, then I played the trumpet, and then I played the baritone, and then I settled on tuba because my high school was very small, and the band didn't have a tuba player. And I felt like I was a big enough kid to be able to carry it.
Okay, but are those those seem to me like I don't want to stereotype or overgeneralize. Those seem to me, because I associate those with classical, which I would, with most children, but not all, I would associate those with instruments that maybe a parent made me take up.
No.
You were actually interested in these?
Yeah, I mean, my mom tried to teach me to play piano.
She played?
She did.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't really take to it.
Didn't do it for you?
No, and I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if I really had to, I mean, if you want to lay me down on the couch and I really had to go into my head.
This is your second therapy reference.
Yeah.
I think you need to treat yourself to some analysis.
You know, I already had my parents as teachers in school, and then she was teaching me trying to teach me to play piano. I just kind of recoiled at it, I think. But the other, you know, the cello and being part of a music program was definitely something that they wanted me to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think first from an educational standpoint and a learning standpoint. And then I, much like the kitchen, in the move from middle school to high school, I wasn't sold on being in the marching band.
Mm.
But I really wanted to play junior golf. And so you can play junior golf and be in the marching band at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got in the marching band, I found this really great sense of teamwork, which is one of the things that drew me to the kitchen. And something that I really immediately, before I even enjoyed researching cuisine or thinking about the food that I was cooking, mm-hmm. I really just loved the teamwork part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the teamwork aspect of being in the marching band was great. I mean, obviously, I was enough of a team player that when they needed a tuba player, I just raised my hand and said, I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I think a lot of high school kids are in this situation, I was pretty quick to achieve with the tuba. So mm-hmm. I enjoyed the attention that came with being good at something. And so that kind of fed what I was doing. I also really enjoyed the work that you could put in with it. I mean, you're already probably seeing a lot of parallels to cooking, but mm-hmm. that the, you know, if you're going to sit and practice for 4 or 5 hours a day, you're going to get better. I mean, there are no two ways about
mm-hmm.
it.
At least at the craft part of it.
Sure. Yeah, the
you may not become a virtuoso.
But you're going to learn scales
right.
and
you'll be a dependable part of the team,
yeah.
a cog.
Absolutely.
Yeah, at a minimum.
And
yeah.
so, you know, I was good enough to get into some schools, went to school for music, and there were, I mean, of the class that I was in of tuba players, I think most of them are either playing or teaching professionally right now.
Mm.
And I got to a point where I could see, you know, when we would go out away from the music building, every one of those people that I went to school with loved what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to realize that
mm-hmm.
on top of all of the work that you have to put in order to be just be good, not even worry about being great, you have to love it too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are people who would go into the music library and they would just listen to symphonies or chamber music. Or I would do that, but only if it had a tuba part in it.
Well, you're also now, and I suspect that you're about to describe a time when you had that level of interest, and that was probably with food, because you were describing, you know, young cooks.
Yeah.
A lot of them, you know, they have the job. It's like, you know, you're working these crazy hours, and then they come home and they're either watching Netflix or either watching Chef's Table or,
sure.
or learning how to do watching demos on YouTube or going through cookbooks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until you're like basically falling asleep.
And that's when I knew. You know, moving forward, that's when I knew that cooking and professional restaurant cooking was for me, because I was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just putting in the hours and putting in the time that was necessary to do the job.
Yeah.
It was an all-consuming passion
mm-hmm.
on top of trying to really build a craft. And I think they're two very different things.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be able to do both in order to really progress.
Yeah. So where did the passion come from? How did you discover... what was sort of the spark for you to go after the food thing?
And I don't know. I think that it's probably what a lot of people end up saying. And this goes back to the music part of it. You know, if you go and take an audition for a symphony, or
mm-hmm.
you know, it may be weeks until you find out how you did.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And that would always drive me crazy. I mean, they'd always say, well, just forget that you even took... I mean, come on, forget that you even
right.
did that?
Right.
And so I think one of the things that really attracted me about cooking was I can spend X amount of time to make a plate of food and I can serve it to you, and immediately I know if you liked it or not.
Yeah.
Without you saying a word. Because that's the big thing, too. You know, chefs come out into the dining room, ask how everything was. Everyone always says, well, it was great.
Yeah.
We're looking at your eyes to see really, you know, did it take you somewhere?
Yeah.
Did it really, plate? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Did it do something for you? One, on a very basic level of sustenance. I mean,
sure.
You know, you're hungry, so you eat.
Mm-hmm.
But when you can reach another level, that was really gratifying for me. It
mm-hmm.
was really something that I knew immediately. I enjoyed seeing that reaction. And strangely enough, good or bad, you know, if there was something, and as you're learning, you're going to screw up a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to, you know, you got to be able to take the roll with the punches a little bit.
Sure.
That's how you're going to learn. I mean, they, you know, golf influences my life a lot too. It's sort of my that's my therapy session when I
right, that's your happy
kitchen.
Place,
yeah.
As some people
and,
would say.
And everybody says, you know, you learn more from losing than you do from, you know, from winning 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
You lose once and you'll learn. And it's the same thing with cooking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may think that you've got it down, and that immediate fix is something that's, I think, is really special about what we're able to do as chefs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do you start pursuing it?
I just started cooking. I mean, I started, and I was really pretty awful at it. I started waiting tables.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was
always... Is that because that was the thing that was available
it was
to you?
It was open. Yeah. And
what kind
know,
of place?
It was a country club.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just always be in the kitchen. You know, I was not on the floor. I was mm-hmm. not a very attentive waiter. And so I think finally they just gave up, and there was a spot in the kitchen. They said, well, why don't we just put him in the kitchen? But, you know, it was at that time, there's a really great chef who's young. He was younger than I was, who was at the country club, and we would sit around on downtime, and there would be, you know, and I think that these books, this isn't an ad for these books, but I think that they stand up today as much as they did when we were looking at them. The Charlie Trotter books, the vegetable, meat and game, seafood,
mm-hmm.
dessert books.
Mm-hmm.
We would just sit and look at those books. I mean, when other people were throwing darts or smoking cigarettes or doing whatever, we were pouring through all these books. And then we would go and he had the latitude to be able to order in whatever, so we would cook out of those.
You cooked out of Trotter's books?
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
my God.
If there was going to be a wine dinner,
that's a lot of work.
We would just totally rip that stuff off.
Yeah. We just have to say, those books, first of all, very often, you know, the photographs were, like, they zoomed in super close.
Yeah, Tim Turner,
so,
I think,
right.
shot
so
the
that's
the photographs.
Right. So very often, though, you would see something super close. It's an oversized book. One page would be... you know, the recipe, and the facing page or the page opposite it would be this picture.
Yeah.
And the recipe page was not very big type, and there would very often be 6, 7, 8 different preparations.
Right.
But the thing it produced was like a size, often like a canapé.
Yeah.
You know, like really small.
Yeah.
You know, most cooks I know, well, that's why I stopped and said, like, you actually cooked out of it?
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of cooks who took a lot of inspiration just from the visuals,
mm-hmm.
especially at the time.
Yeah.
Right? Because it was so, even a book that size was a new thing.
Yeah.
I think the French Laundry cookbook was largely... influenced or inspired by, to some extent, Charlie's books.
Yeah.
You know? But you actually cooked out of them.
Yeah.
That must have been an education in itself.
It was an education in a lot of profanity, I think. Because I think we found that either we didn't have the technique that the recipes were describing, because you're
yeah.
right. I mean, they were very... I know that we're allowed to swear on this. I've heard other people.
Yeah.
It was no bullshit
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it
yeah.
was, this
yeah.
is how we do it.
Yes.
And
yeah, this was not like dumbed down or whatever for the home cook.
No, it wasn't scrubbed for the yeah. home cook. It was, this is it.
Yeah, if you want to make this dish, this is how we do it. Yeah.
And so, you know, between that, we would, you know, it was a country club, so Mondays we were closed. We would all jump in a car and go to Philadelphia and eat. And
what, like Le Bec Fan and stuff
it was
like
just,
that?
Well, downstairs. We were still line cooks. We weren't eating upstairs.
Okay.
But, you know, even to go to the Reading Terminal Market and
yeah.
look around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, get exposed to some of the great ethnic food that Philadelphia
yeah.
had. Philadelphia was the closest big city.
Uh-huh. She's so, like South Philly and eat like...
just crushed cheesesteaks
yeah,
and roast
Italian
pork sandwiches.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. yeah.
And so that, I had gotten to a point, and, you know, I think that this was either on the edge of or just before the chef pulled me aside, and he's like, if you want to go any further in this business, you need to go to culinary school. Which, now is not something that I necessarily recommend. I feel like there are so many great restaurants that just go work at great restaurants and, you know, bop around that way. So from there, I went to CIA.
Yeah. Could I ask, what year roughly are we talking?
2001, 2000. Do you remember, were you in New York for the blackout?
The blackout that happened like a year after the 9/11 attacks? Yeah.
So right around that time. Because I was around for the blackout.
I was
horribly behind. I was wicked in the shits, and all the electricity went off. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, this is the best day of my life. Because I'm already halfway prepped for tomorrow, but I was in no way ready for tonight.
Well, I don't know. People who aren't in New York probably don't know, but like everyone here was wondering if we were being softened up for another hit.
Yeah.
Like That's the only reason it was even, noteworthy event, really.
Because it was pretty close.
It was near the same timing, almost. And I think it might have been 2 years after. Maybe. I don't remember.
Well, because there was...
But there might have been a year in between. But in any event, it was... People were worried.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, and somewhere in between there was... there was that plane went down in
Queens. Yep.
You know, that was a huge deal. So, that was around that time.
Yeah.
I enjoyed my time in Hyde Park. I think probably the thing I liked about it most was its proximity to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, we don't need to get off and go down the rabbit hole of culinary school, but we can if you want. It's real expensive.
It is expensive.
Really expensive.
Yeah.
And I just think back, I was trying to think on the walk over here on a daily basis, and I would almost like to take this as a project and write it down and think about all the things that I do during a day and where did I learn how to do those things and see kind of how that shakes out, because I know that there are a lot of times where I'm calling on those initial couple of years of working at a country club, because you get everything thrown at you at a country club.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it all the way from cooking out of the Charlie Trotter Meet and Game book to can you throw on a pizza for the kids down at the pool?
Right.
Sometimes at the same time.
Yeah.
And if you don't think that that's not a great training ground, you've never done it, because it absolutely is.
It's funny. I don't know why this just popped into my head, but years ago we went, we were at some place, maybe up in like Lake George.
Yeah,
maybe it was up there, and we were in like some pub, one of the restaurants on site at this resort.
Yeah,
and I ordered some fried fish or something like that, and I asked the server if they had tartar sauce, and they didn't. And the chef, and no one knew I was like a food writer or anything, but the chef came out with, he had whipped up some tartar sauce.
Yeah,
and I wasn't shocked, but I said to my wife, I said, that's old school.
Yeah,
but that's the kind of thing you're talking about. Yeah. Like, do you have the skill set to accommodate whatever comes your way?
And, a lot of it is basic cooking.
Right.
I worked at a restaurant once, and the chef came in, and he asked one of the cooks for shrimp salad. You just want shrimp. And immediately I was like, fine, shrimp salad sandwich, whatever. And that literally threw a wrench into this guy's day. Like, he wasn't sure if it was grilled shrimp on a salad. He just didn't know how to immediately be like, tartar sauce, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bang that out for you quick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those types of quick reactions and being able to make, you have this in your head, sort of the professional joy of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Can you make these, things that people are going to ask for? If you can't make tartar sauce, come on. There's a ton of other things you should probably be doing with your life, but cooking is not one of them.
Well, I was so blown away. Near my house, I live in Westchester County, just north of the city. And on the Sawmill Parkway, there is a place called La Linterna. It's just a little Italian restaurant. Mm-hmm. I happen to know because some local bartenders sent me there and told me about the guy who owns it. It's a couple that owns it.
Yeah.
The husband's the chef. And he trained in Switzerland, but he's of Italian descent. And so the menu, it's basically an Italian restaurant. The menu has a note on it that says, if there's something you want and you don't see it on the menu, ask. And if we have the ingredients,
I'll make it.
We will make it.
See,
and
I want to go there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing. And this place is, I'm telling you, it's like maybe 35 seats plus a little room with a bar.
Yeah.
I eat at the bar. And then they have a beer garden outside in the summer. And I was like, they have that here, and I've never seen that note anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I mean, the menu there, it's like, you know, shrimp with tomato and garlic and, you know, pizza. And I mean, it's so fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys obviously had, you know, some serious training.
Well, and the thing, too, I mean, I, you know, at Josephine, we write out a family meal menu every week. So everyone knows what they're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And the two things that I'm hardest on, without a doubt, is spaghetti and meatballs and meatloaf. Because I feel like those are two staples of just being able to cook
mm-hmm.
and taking the care to make it well. That you just, if you can hold down a station at a Michelin 3-star restaurant, great, and you know. But I sort of feel like from a craftsperson standpoint, there ought to be, you know, this is an oyster bar.
Mm-hmm.
You know? How good are you at chucking oysters? I don't mm-hmm. care if you work in an oyster restaurant or not. If it's something that people put in their mouth and you care about cooking,
mm-hmm.
then if you've taken the time to, and it's, you know, again, a lifelong learning situation. I think it's one thing that I love about
mm-hmm.
cooking in general, not just professional cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But do you know how to make basics so that you can just, boom, you know, tartar
yeah.
sauce?
Yeah.
I mean, I love that. I love this, you know, this restaurant in Westchester County. It's just to be able to welcome someone into your home.
Yeah.
And say, this is what we have on the menu, but if we've got it, I'm going to make it for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Come on. I mean,
I know. It's fun. Well, you know, and to your point, Jimmy Bradley, who I used to do a podcast with called The Front Burner on Heritage Radio Network, who had the restaurant The Red Cat, which
yeah.
he just closed after 19 years, he, if someone was applying to work for him, sometimes he would say, go make me a salad.
Yeah.
And sure. that was the only instruction.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do an omelet.
Yeah, well,
everyone
yeah.
that comes through, I mean, it's pretty standard.
Yep.
The one that's not standard is, and you'd be surprised at how many people this catches, make an omelet and show me how to light the pilot on the oven.
Oh, that's a good one.
And there are a lot of blank stares.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, again, not just light the pilot, but do you know how to break down a 6-burner and
yeah.
clean it and put it
yeah,
all back together?
Right,
I mean,
right.
again, that's another what I feel like is a basic
yep.
of the job of being a craftsperson. Take care right. of your tools, they'll take care of you.
Right. Okay, so when do you go to work for Chef O'Connell?
After culinary school.
It was.
Yeah.
Okay, so
well,
you go...
And as part of an extern.
Oh, that was an externship.
Yeah.
So you go to... I think you're the first guest we've ever had on the show who spent time there.
Sweet.
So the Inn at Little Washington
yeah.
is a landmark restaurant. It just celebrated its 40th anniversary.
Now that we're bringing it up, that's where the shrimp salad
okay.
came from.
The chef is Patrick O'Connell. He
yeah.
recently realized a lifelong dream and got a third Michelin star.
Yeah.
But you go from there. Tell us why you wanted to work there and what was it like there? I've actually never been there.
Oh, it's magic. You need to go.
Tell me.
I've never actually eaten there.
Uh-huh.
I got the book first, when I was still before...
His cookbook.
Yeah, the
uh-huh.
first one.
Yeah.
Before I even went to culinary school, any of it, I got it and started to page through it and just the, you know, and this is, you know, this is late 90s, early 2000s, the sense of place that came from there prior to Noma and, you know, a lot of... That's just kind of what we're doing now, is we're talking about sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
But for that place, and, you know, to be, it was close. You know, I went to undergrad school in Harrisonburg, Virginia, so
okay.
I was, you know, very familiar with that area. But I love the idea that you could go, and, I didn't grow up with this, you know, fantastical idea of the great inns of Europe or anything like that. But with... the Inn at Little Washington, I love the idea that you could go to this little town and for the minute you were there until the minute you left, they were taking care of every detail.
Mm-hmm.
I found that so inspiring that you could do that for someone.
Mm-hmm.
You could provide an experience where they could leave restored, but also leave everything else at the door.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there... and I'm not sure if it's this way or not anymore, there were, we had cell phones. I'm not that old, but the cell phones didn't work out there.
Mm-hmm.
There was, the service was not great. So you really were leaving the world behind.
Mm-hmm.
I committed the book to memory and then just decided that I really wanted to work there. Mm-hmm. And I knew that, that Omelet Test was part of their, you know, their thing when
okay.
you go and do a trail. It's 2 days. So I went to, if anyone was working at the Poughkeepsie Macy's in the early 2000s, I went and bought an all-clad, like a really nice all-clad nonstick pan and would just practice at home.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went down and did the interview and got the job, I shined that pan up and put it back in the box and returned it to Macy's because I didn't have the money to...
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You got away with that?
I did.
Wow.
I got my money back.
Wow.
Which I certainly needed at the
time. That is some skill.
But I started in the dish room. I started as a dishwasher there. I think that at that time, it may still be that way. Everyone does.
Okay.
That's kind of your entry into the
mm-hmm.
kitchen. So the first 6 weeks that I was there, I was in the dish room. And I still remember very vividly the first thing that I was allowed to cook. Was family meal.
Mm.
And in 6 weeks of working there, and you're working around all of this amazing produce. I mean, everything there is completely dialed in.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't touch any of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was washing dishes and washing mm-hmm. glasses. So the minute that I was able to make family meal, and I just made a basic stew, but I was so excited about it, I took it into the executive sous chef in the office. He probably thought I was nuts. I was like, hey, will you taste this? Because I'm just so excited to be cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Again. And it was, that was a, I don't want to say that it was a hard place to work. It was definitely challenging.
How so?
I think it's probably like when, really good high school athletes go to play a sport in college or, a great college athlete goes to the pros. You're around people who are all, they're just,
all are
good.
All stars.
I mean, they are so good at what they do. And it's, it's not a little intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole lot intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
And so that that's difficult. It was just a little tough to get used to,
mm-hmm.
to know that there are so many people who are operating at such a high level.
Yeah.
But no better place to learn and
mm-hmm.
get better fast.
Because
you're either going to get better or you're going to get gone.
Did the experience of cooking family meal, did that give a little more roundness to your view of cooking? The reason I ask is Thomas Keller, historical footnote in his life, his first job in a proper kitchen after working grills and stuff, when he met his mentor, Roland Hennen, the first job he was handed at the Dunes Club in Rhode Island was staff meal.
Sure.
And he talks about that was when he recognized that even if he was just making, spaghetti and meatballs or whatever, that he was feeding these people who'd been working really hard
mm-hmm.
and that the delivery of pleasure to these people, he says that was the epiphany for him of when he realized that was priority one.
So here's the way I look at that. If I'm going to cook for you, whether you're paying for it or not, I want to see that look on your face.
Yeah.
Same thing, although, so, you have the restaurant guests, and then you have the people that work in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And in family meal, you're cooking for those people that you spend more time with than you do your own family at home.
Yeah.
Unless you're lucky like me and you get to work with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, 100%, you're still looking for that same aha moment or just general look of satisfaction from the people who are eating the food that you're making.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how personal that is. You're making something with your hand that someone is going to put into their body. One, to nourish them, but also to nourish them mentally because you set up, most restaurant family meals are prior to the dinner service. You make a great family meal, you've just set the stage for a great service. And so I think it's really important, but also, I mean, we'll just go back to tartar sauce. If you can make family meal out of what's in the walk-in,
yeah,
that's a great way for you to be able to, on the fly, come up with something that's delicious.
Mm.
Using stuff that's not...
expensive, luxury.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Exotic.
And, you know, frankly... I think that people in restaurants, you know, if we shaved truffle over something for family meal, they just think I was nuts, and they don't really want that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, you can go into the walk-in and you can immediately, you know, take in 8 ingredients and just think, you know, sort of flip through your mental Rolodex of recipes and flavor mm-hmm. thoughts and say, I got it. I can make something with that.
Mm-hmm.
So the really great thing about that is when at 8:15 on a Saturday night somebody comes in and says, can I have X?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that we can make that. If we have it, we can
mm-hmm.
make it.
Mm-hmm.
We can only do that if you've gone through every day of assessing what's in front of you and just being able to cook.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's really important, and from a, you know, from a skill standpoint, you've got to be able to do things quickly and on
mm-hmm.
the fly. I mean, again,
mm-hmm.
back to golf, it's nobody ever hits it down the middle all the time.
Right.
The guys who are great and the women who are great are the ones who hit it out of the trees
mm-hmm.
and still make birdie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, being able to hit it out of the trees is being able to find 6 ingredients. And I'm not talking like, you know, chopped, which is ingredients from everywhere. It's just, you know, you've got some stuff in the walk-in. Can you make it delicious?
Mm-hmm.
And then can you make people happy because it was super delicious?
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. So how... Well, take me through your next gig.
So I was a sous chef quickly outside of Baltimore for a guy who had worked for Michelle Richard,
mm-hmm.
Which was a great experience. I mean, it was my first real experience of... having to manage a small staff.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there went and, you know, at this point, I'm still kind of hot on the idea of an inn with a restaurant. And so I applied to an inn that was north of New Hope, Pennsylvania, sort of in between New York and Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
In Bucks County, and got that job. It's a 60-seat restaurant, had 18 rooms in the inn. And I was pretty much by myself in the kitchen.
Literally.
Yeah. There were times when my parents were still teaching. And so there were a fair amount of weekends where they would come over and help wash dishes. And, I mean, it was a while until I got... I had a friend who cooked with me for a while. I had an intern work with me. But it was...
Wow.
Yeah. But... you know, it's another great way that it informed what was going to happen later in my career was if you're the only person in the kitchen, nobody's helping you out with your prep list.
Yeah.
And service is coming, so
yeah.
You got to figure out how to get it done.
So how long were your days? You were doing all your own prep and you were cooking for service.
Yeah, the restaurant was only open, see if I remember, either Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It was a,
it's probably,
you know,
the
people
latter,
were coming out
guess.
Thursday,
yeah.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday,
yeah,
I think is what we
that's
did.
That's what I would guess.
So, because I don't know when to quit, it was sat on 26 acres, so
mm-hmm.
we started to raise a lot of our own vegetables and herbs.
Mm-hmm.
So my days that I wasn't in the kitchen, I was out doing that.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, I grew up with... my dad really enjoyed gardening, and so he would come over and help. And then we would, you know, people would come on a Friday night, and I would stop, and people, as they're having cocktails, would invite them to come out through the gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived on the property, and it was a super, super cool place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just one of those things. The people who owned it ended up selling it.
Mm-hmm.
So it got turned into a weekend home for a wealthy person from Manhattan.
Understood. So when you're cooking there, how do you start developing what you would consider your stuff? You're shaking your head no.
I didn't.
So what were you cooking there? Was it classics?
Well...
Or fairly conservative?
So,
I mean, Bucks County, for people who don't know, this is, it's not the most, people don't go there looking for cutting edge cuisine.
No. And I think that I didn't have a style at that point. I was still too young. And I think that, so Craig LeBan, who is the, I guess he's still the restaurant critic for the
Philadelphia Inquirer,
reviewed, it was Evermay when I was there, and I remember still talking to him on the phone, and his description of what we were doing at Evermay, it was actually a question, but it was in the question was a description. He said, so is this basically going to be the Inn at Little French Laundry? And my response was, I mean, I don't know, but it's exactly what it was. I was cooking the stuff that I knew from the Inn at Little Washington. I was crushing French Laundry cookbooks. Like, I mean, I've probably been through, like every other chef these days, you know, a lot of those books. And mm-hmm. it was like, hey, these are the, and then, you know, sprinkle in a little bit of Charlie Trotter. These are the restaurants that I admire. I'm not a skilled enough craftsperson yet to have my own style. So it's a little bit like artists. So I'm going to go through and I'm going to copy, mm-hmm. copy. And as I'm copying, then start to develop my own style. Mm-hmm. I can't say that anything that I did there I would consider, if you can consider anything in cooking original
mm-hmm.
thought,
mm-hmm.
it was a lot of, I know these recipes work.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it, too, is a little bit of an immature young chef of, well, if these recipes work at Inn at Little Washington or at the French Laundry or at Charlie Trotter's, then no one has any right telling me they don't like it because they like it at those places mm-hmm. and I'm just following the recipe. You know
right.
what I mean?
I do.
So there was a fair amount of that. I think that it wasn't really until I went home. I was able to go back to my hometown for 6 years and mm-hmm. cook there where I really feel like I started to develop, if I have a style, I mean, that's when I really started to look into how can I take this food from central Pennsylvania and add a bit of shine and elegance to
mm-hmm.
it. So that, you know, that's the perspective part of it, is I was looking at these restaurants that were doing very refined food,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, country mid-Atlantic or you know French or American inspired French or you know Charlie Trotter's sort of global influences. At the end of the day, when you look at those plates, this is something I love too, is that you can immediately tell a Charlie Trotter plate.
Oh yeah,
you can immediately tell a Keller plate, you can immediately
yeah.
tell it one of Patrick's plates. They were all very refined and very clean,
mm-hmm.
and so how can I start to do that and represent the food that I grew up with?
Mm-hmm.
I think at that point, that's when I started to develop some type of a style. But I would like to consider it more of a perspective on cooking. You know, your life experiences, if that's the, you know, I guess Keller has this term of personality cuisine, which is
yes.
driving a lot
mm-hmm.
of chef-driven restaurants today.
Yeah. Well, he used it as a descriptor of nouvelle cuisine.
Sure. And
yeah.
so it's, to me, it's perspective cuisine. You know, I've
mm-hmm.
been to, I've traveled in Europe a little bit. I have this classic training, but also then my perspective is growing up in central Pennsylvania and,
sure.
and those type of foods. And now taking that and picking that up and putting it in the American South.
Sure.
Which is the perfect place to be.
Mm.
You know, if you think about the parallels between the Pennsylvania Dutch food and
mm-hmm.
the food of the American South, they're very similar.
Mm. When why do you decide to move down to Nashville?
So the inn and restaurant where I was working in my hometown closed.
Yep.
And my wife and I were looking literally everywhere. We even, I don't think that, you know, my parents are going to listen to this and they will definitely not be super stoked about it. We were considering moving to Europe.
Mm. What country?
I really kind of wanted to either move to France or Germany or
interesting.
Alsace.
Mm-hmm.
just because it kind of fits, you know, the stuff that I like to do.
You're opening like some country mom and pop.
Yeah, and probably one of the dumber decisions ever, just going over there and just trying to work.
Wing it? You know?
Yeah. I have a life of bad decisions.
We didn't make that decision.
So we, you know, my wife is from, her family is from Knoxville, Tennessee.
Aha.
And every year when we would go to visit them, we would drive down to Knoxville and spend some time around the holidays. And I always wanted to go to Nashville but it's after the drive to Knoxville, thinking about driving another 3 hours was like, I don't think Nashville can be that interesting for me to want to drive 6 more hours.
Yeah.
So there was an ad on Star Chef's website for a new restaurant that was opening in Nashville. And I sent my information in, and I just thought, you know, if this works out, I'll go down and take the interview, and at the very least, we'll get to see Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to Nashville. I mean, I got through the interview process and went down to cook and was going to spend 5 days in Nashville. And in the first day, we pulled in, and I looked around, and I'm not a fan of this sort of mystic idea of, you know, I just had a moment where you could feel the energy or things like that. But I had a moment, and you could feel the energy. I mean, you could feel the energy of what was happening in the city.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, Husk had just opened.
Mm-hmm.
And
Sean Brock's place.
Right. And Catbird Seat, you know, Josh and Eric were getting a lot of really, really great press for what they were doing at Catbird Seat. And Rolf and Daughters had just gotten on the Bon Appetit Best New Restaurants list, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So there, people were paying attention to Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that they weren't paying attention to the small little town that I was in Pennsylvania. And then the other thing that we were, you know, because one of our thought processes prior to going to Nashville was, well, you know, if I'm starting to see food through this Pennsylvania Dutch perspective, why don't we just go and open a place in Philadelphia? Because it seems like...
In the city.
Yeah, that seems like a good idea.
Uh-huh.
Because that's where the food... Everything's there. People are there.
People,
you know,
get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so this came up. This idea came up. And we went down to Nashville. And so I got hooked up with Mark Vetri and Jeff Benjamin. It's kind of actually more Jeff with just providing me some perspective on operating a restaurant in Philadelphia or restaurants in Philadelphia. And one of the things that he said to me that really stuck with me was, when you're looking around at places to put a restaurant, go where the big cranes are. And
meaning where there's a lot of development.
And he's like, if there are big cranes, it means there's a lot of development. And people have already put the mental work into the fact that that's an area that's going to be taking off. And there's big money behind
it. Funny. Yeah.
And so when we pulled into Nashville, it was like...
A lot of big cranes.
And I looked at Karen and I was like, remember what Jeff said about the cranes? And she said, yeah, and we're just... And it continues. I mean, 5 years in, it continues to be that way.
Yeah.
But we really fell in love with the energy of the city. It, you know, from a, we haven't even really touched on ingredients too much, but something when I was in Pennsylvania, you know, I had the gardens and was very involved with, as, you know, farm to table has sort of become this thing now.
Well, excuse me. It's always been a thing.
Always been a thing.
The phrase farm to table has become a thing.
There you go. And I just feel like, you know, we should always be buying the best products we can.
Sure.
But I knew the growing seasons were going to be a little longer. Not by much. We've gotten some snow down there, which is a little different.
Yeah.
But that there, you know, there would be access to a different type of product and something that would not be possible in Philadelphia is, so there's this kind of neat thing where if you have you have your perspective, and so for me that's the Pennsylvania Dutch cuisine, but then when you take the ingredients and the raw materials of food from the South, it changes it a little bit in a way that I think is great. It's kind of like adding another, peeling off another layer of the onion. You're adding another layer onto it that can make it a little bit more complex.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not dealing with, a certain type of pork that's grown specifically in this area of Pennsylvania. Well, now it's, if we're going to make scrapple, it's going to taste a little different because it's from a hog that's from Tennessee.
You know what it reminds me of? Mike Nichols, who was a big theater and movie director,
yeah.
He had a line about casting. And he said that his philosophy of casting was that you would imagine the perfect, what most people would consider the perfect actor.
Yeah.
And then you'd move about 10% off of that, right? And that's what this reminds me of.
Yeah.
Like you're taking something that, you gave the example of the pork for scrapple. Like you're making scrapple, but you're using the right thing, but you're using like the cousin of the usual.
Sure.
And that makes it unexpected, that makes it a little more your own, that makes it more just basically interesting.
And uniquely of the place that it comes
and
from.
And uniquely of the place, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So it's funny, we had we had Rob Aiken on recently, mm-hmm. who was, I forget the name off the top of my head, but he was at he's British born, but he was doing his take on Oaxacan food in the D.C. area.
Yeah.
He's since moved back to New York City. I think he's going to be the chef of the new pastis.
Oh, wow.
But his whole thing was taking what he was getting from farms uh-huh. around the D.C. area mm-hmm. and incorporating it into a Oaxacan package, right?
And so how cool is that? Because you're building another...
Yeah.
You could be in D.C. or you could be in Oaxaca or you could be in this kind of cool combination
yeah.
of the two.
Yeah.
And
you're like the matchmaker. Like you as the chef are the, you're the other ingredient.
You're pulling a taste out of from, again, his own personal perspective is going
yeah.
to add to
yeah.
that. And I think when you get, that's a little bit the tightrope, though, that we walk as chefs is there's the opportunity for that to be remarkable.
Yeah.
There's also the opportunity for you to fall flat on your face.
Oh, sure.
100%. And I think that people going to these, personality-driven restaurants, they're starting to see that I could have a really, really amazing one-of-a-kind experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way this is all set up.
Yeah.
I think that that's great. And the fact that we're able to do things like that in the United States is super rewarding
mm-hmm.
as a chef,
yeah.
for sure.
So you handed me this book that you, this little
yeah.
booklet you made,
yep.
by Josephine. It's very pretty. And there's a quote in here, which
yeah.
I'm familiar with. It's by the late food writer Josh Ozersky, who I'm proud to say was a friend of mine. And the line is, you just mentioned your scrapple. He wrote at some point, there's a restaurant in Nashville called Josephine, and that restaurant has one of the greatest things I ever ate, which is Andy Little's scrapple.
Yeah.
Okay, so first of all, what is scrapple, for people who don't know?
First of all, can we talk about, I've got a little bit of chills from him. Josh was, he was a good dude.
Oh, I love Josh.
I still remember coming to New York, and he had the, was it Meatopia?
Meatopia.
And he asked me to come and do scrapple for like 3,000 people mm-hmm. at Meatopia.
That wasn't the one where it rained.
And it rained. It?
Oh, God. yeah. Yeah.
that was fun.
And there was also one year where it was like just blazing hot. Like
yeah,
insanely inferno level heat.
I was definitely part of the, I think the tornado sirens are going to go off soon.
Yeah,
rain.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So scrapple... not the sexiest term for it. The term is actually derived from the fact that at the end of the butchering process, you would cook down the scraps that were left over as a way to use every bit of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
Bound with, seasonings added. The seasonings really vary depending on the farm or the butcher or whoever's making it. Almost always with cornmeal and buckwheat flour.
Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of thing you see at roadside places.
Yeah, this. I mean, it's totally
not
a breakfast thing.
Yeah, this is not like a.
I mean, I'm used to, I was the kind of thing I saw, like if I was going to visit my father's family was from Philly.
Yeah.
And you pull over to some roadside joint, it was like something you could have with your eggs.
But
you don't tend to see it outside of that area.
No, and, you know, I think one time I flew into the Philly airport and there was a really great T-shirt. It said "Scrapple the Other Gray Meat" on it, and that's not incorrect.
Yeah. So how did you do yours?
So same thing. I mean, there's some fennel seed in it, which I think really adds a nice part to it. But we use I consider it a little cleaner version of Scrapple. We use chicken liver and then pork shoulder that's ground. You know, you can get Scrapple that is. So there's liver mush, too, which is kind of popular in North Carolina.
Is that what it's called?
Same idea.
They call it liver mush?
I'm pretty sure they call it liver mush.
I've never heard of that.
But, you know, so basically what we're doing is we're taking, over a long cooking time, cooking down these meats and spices, adding a binder in, putting it in a loaf pan and chilling it, and then pulling it out, slicing it, frying it. And we don't vary from that too much. I mean, we make it look a little nicer. We punch it out in a ring mold. But then where it gets, it takes a little bit of a Nashville turn is we take the Scrapple once it's cooked and coat it in what would be considered Nashville hot chicken spices.
Ooh, that sounds good.
So part of the idea is, you know, we want to take my perspective and plant it specifically in Nashville. And so when people are coming in and, you know, you can get a Nashville hot chicken taco. Nashville hot chicken sort of having its moment. But I wanted something that would draw a direct line between where I came from and where I was living and working. And so the Nashville hot scrapple kind of, you know, they serve it with you can go and get it with white bread and pickles. So the sauce for the scrapple is a pickle vinaigrette underneath. And it's a fun way of saying, you know, welcome to Nashville.
I love it.
Through the perspective of someone who has lived in the Northeast and grew up in central Pennsylvania.
And has serious chops.
Well, come to dinner. You can decide.
Okay, fine. If you want to be modest, has serious training. Has trained
serious
at
training,
some fairly
sure.
formidable restaurants.
There you go. I'll take that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's refined.
It is. It's refined. But then you can also come, if you come to brunch, you will get a slab of Scrapple as part of your, just like you would get going out to visit your family. I mean, same thing. You know, it's texture is a huge thing for me. I think it's a huge thing for a lot of people that really kind of dive into food. So the Scrapple with this, you know, crispy exterior and then the inside's almost creamy. You know, yeah, it's pretty fun for sure.
When you say texture is important to you, or is there a certain texture that you tend to always incorporate? Like, are you a crunch guy?
I think that there needs to be a good balance. Like a couple nights ago, I went to Folk, which is the new restaurant from Philip Krajicek, who has Rolf and Daughters, and he has this chestnut panna cotta on dessert. And panna cotta, as it is, there's, you know, it's pudding. But then, you know, he puts a crumble on top and this textural element that just adds a balance to it. So I can't necessarily say that I would always go for crunch, but I maybe always go for balance in the textures. You know, I don't want everything to be too soft and squishy. I don't want everything to be too hard and jagged.
I want
a little bit of both. And then there's you know, to really kind of dig into it, there's different varieties of soft. I mean, you could get lettuces that are a type of soft on your palate, but then balance them with another lettuce that has a lot of crunch to it. I mean, I'm a big fan of dandelion. So then, you know, outside of texture, that brings in a bitter element that I think plays nicely with kind of the texture of the dandelion itself.
Well, even with panna cotta, right, there's the traditional,
right,
which should barely be holding together. And then there's the, you know, a lot of them now are served in cups or ramekins. Do you do that?
No.
Okay, so I can say this? That's cheating.
That is 100% cheating.
Panna cotta should not be in a vessel.
No, and there should be a healthy amount of. I feel like if you tap the side of the plate,
it should wobble.
Be a healthy amount of jiggle.
Yes, jiggle's another good word for it. Yes, yes. Yeah. Right. It should barely hold its
and
form.
And jiggle in a way that dairy can jiggle, but not jiggle in a way that, like a water-based thing would jiggle.
Yes. I agree. I agree. Okay, so we're on the same page.
We're on the same panicata jiggle page.
Okay, tell me what else for you? Like either things that your customers would consider sort of your signature stuff, or that you personally are most fond of, that you think really sort of sums up who you are and what you do.
So we have this whole chicken on the menu that I know. You know, I think people are of two schools on chicken. One is I'm never going to order chicken out because I can make chicken at home.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is if I want to go to a restaurant and evaluate how good I think the restaurant is, I'm going to have the chicken because the chicken can be very difficult to do well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why we have the chicken on one is because I wanted to be able to prove that we were able to consistently do a great chicken dish. Mm-hmm. It wasn't going to be a throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing, too, is we have two really, really self-indulgent items that never leave our menu. One is this, it's a whole chicken. It's kale dressed in grilled scallion vinaigrette and fingerling potatoes that are first boiled, then we drop them in the fryer and toss them with a vinaigrette that we make from Worcestershire sauce.
Ooh, that sounds good. So
that's on the menu, and then hanger steak and french fries is on the menu, and they never go off.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they never go off is because when I am not working in the restaurant, those are the two things that I want to sit at the bar and eat.
Okay.
So they have to be there because I want to eat them.
Okay.
But I also feel like that is a good way to look at a menu. Back to the whole idea of restaurants being restorative, I want you to be able to come in and if you love chicken, you're going to get the chicken and you're going to crush it. And it's going to feel like putting on the best, your oldest but most favorite sweater.
Yeah.
And the older that I get, the more I'm interested in food like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in food that for me or for whoever else is coming into the restaurant, that there are things that they can get and it just makes them feel like they're walking into their house.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe using techniques that a home cook's not going to take the time to do, but that's that's the point.
Right.
I'm less and less interested in food that super challenges me mentally. I've got enough plumbing things to fix and other stuff that's challenging me mentally. I want to go to a restaurant and I want to feel like I've just been given a big hug.
Mm-hmm.
And so, those two dishes, while they seem simple, and why are you talking about a whole chicken or a hanger steak and french fries, it definitely sums up, regardless of what people were to get on the menu, how I would like for them to feel. I mean, when they come in to the restaurant, they're going to see my wife in the dining room. It's a small, it's 100 seats, but we've had a lot of, our team has been there for years.
Yeah.
And so for people, we like to say welcome home, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually something that is not entirely original. Karen and I were on vacation in September, and we ate at Single Thread. Have you been there?
No.
It's so good.
Where is it?
In Healdsburg, California. Mm-hmm. They just got, I think they've only been open for a couple of years. They have their third Michelin star already. And again, the perspective there is fantastic, but there were these wooden pieces that they were serving the food on, and so we just asked, where are those made? And the waiter's response was, they're made by an artist in Japan, brings them over, and they make a really, really great accent to our home.
Mm.
And I could tell, the minute that she walked away, I looked at Karen and I just thought, I love the fact that we're in a really, really amazing restaurant.
Yeah.
And they're talking about it in the sense that it's their home.
Yeah.
Well, people love to throw dinner parties, and as professional cooks, we're able to do that on a nightly basis. But do we really think about it in those terms?
Right.
I don't know. And so we wanted to make it a focus of wanting people to feel like they're coming into, regardless of what's going on with the rest of the day,
mm-hmm.
the minute the door opens,
mm-hmm.
if you can feel great about coming in, then the menu, the menu's a little bit like a machine.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, yeah, there might be, you might love halibut and we're going to have halibut on there. But our goal is to make it so that regardless of what you eat, you leave feeling restored, feeling like it's just your favorite place to be. Maybe a little more dressed up than if you were to, you know, come down to your dining room table and gym shorts and you know, flip-flops.
But
that it really feels that way. So I think, you know, what can people expect, or, you know, what signature dish kind of things. You know, I would go back to the chicken, and, you know, we obviously do some things with pretzel. That's a big central Pennsylvania thing. But it's more the perspective and the feeling that I would like people to have. I would like to think of that more as our signature dish than any one specific food item.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right. Well, it was great meeting you.
It was awesome meeting you.
Thanks for making the time on your
trip. Yeah, yeah, this is great.
Can I say, and thanks for being a listener.
Well, yeah. I love listening to this.
Yeah. No, things. I sometimes say everyone in the business listens to my show except my guests.
No, it's not true at all. Come on, you think?
Well, a lot of times when I'm setting up the mics, I'm like, you know, I want to make sure people know the drill. Like, I tape the intros later, and da-da-da-da. And a lot of times the guests haven't heard the show.
No, and you know, the other thing, too, I mean, I will mention this now that we're actually taping, and we talked about it earlier, is that I know that the team at Josephine is very excited about this, but also I have a ton of, I think that this particular podcast, not to blow smoke up your ass, because I'm not going
to
do
I wasn't that, trying to set this up, by the way, but yes.
But it's a very important part. I mean, people are so interested in, this is the real deal of what happens in restaurants and what chefs are thinking. And people are very interested in that, not just the chef community, but the general dining public. I mean, if you want to know what working chefs are thinking, feeling, doing, this is the podcast to go to. So I mean, I think it's a great bridge for, it's a great thing, one, for line cooks, sous chefs, whatever, people in the business to be able to listen to. It's a great thing for anyone who's interested in food and just dining culture to listen to as well.
Thank you very much. So, I wasn't fishing for that, but I'll take it.
You got it. You landed a big fish.
All right. On that note, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. A huge thank you to Manit Chauhan and to Andy Little for making time to sit with us during a short visit to New York City for each of them. Also, our thanks to Jeet Paul, our engineer, who's just been an incredible font of patience and support over the last few weeks when I was down and out with my illness. Thank you again to Danny Abrams and the Mermaid Inn restaurants in New York City for becoming our studio away from home when we need one. It's been an incredible resource for us, and we do appreciate it. I also want to remind listeners, if you are interested, you can follow the show on Instagram. The handle is @ChefPodcast. You can also subscribe for free at iTunes, Stitcher. You can also listen on Spotify. Pretty much wherever you can find a podcast, you can follow this show, and I hope you will do that. And as a reminder, on April 8th and 9th, I will be participating in the Chef's Roll Anti-Conference in San Diego, California. I'll be presenting a panel discussion based on my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And I'll also be participating in a panel about the media. And I'll be around. So if you're out there, please come say hi. Love to meet you in person. That's it. That's our show for this week. Thank you for listening, and we will see you back here next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.